Hello and welcome to the Weekly Defence Podcast, the show about defence procurement and military technology. We are brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, NAMO. I'm your host, Richard Thomas, and on the show this week, VP Content Tony Skinner speaks to Tom Eskriet, who is the campaign lead for Information Advantage at Roke, about situational awareness on the modern battlefield. I grab a chat with Asia-Pacific editor Gordon Arthur on the breaking news and programme developments from the past 30 days in the Asia-Pacific region, and our sponsor NAMO provides this week's industry voice. But first, the news. In Russia, Sukhoi plans to begin deliveries this year of its Su-57 fifth-generation fighter slightly later than intended after a test aircraft crashed near Khabarovsk in December last year. The Russian Air Force ordered 76 Su-57s in 2019 in a deal worth about $2 billion, although early prototype aircraft have already been tested by the VKS in operations over Syria. As well as an array of conventional missiles, the Su-57 will also carry a small intra-fuselage hypersonic missile, and the aircraft would also take advantage of artificial intelligence to ensure better interaction and synchronized operations with combat UAVs. In the Czech Republic, we have information that suggests the possible delay or even cancellation of the country's programme to buy 210 new IFVs, which the country's armed forces urgently require. The programme has been allocated an estimated $1.9 billion to replace the Czech Army's obsolete BVP-2s. The Czech MOD, which has received initial bids in late 2019, was expected to select the preferred platform this year. Under the new circumstances, the MOD might delay negotiations with bidders while awaiting further instructions. Similar delays have hit the Croatian government's efforts to buy new multi-role fighters to replace its ageing MiG-21 fleet. Officials said that funding for the programme is being diverted to meet near-term priorities. In Italy, the country remains one of the most badly hit by the COVID-19 pandemic across Europe. The launch of the second-in-class PPA patrol vessel Francesco Morosini has slipped due to the pandemic and industrial restrictions in the country. To date, 7 PPA vessels have been ordered for the Italian Navy, with 2 more on option. It's thought that up to 16 could be eventually procured. However, due to the COVID-19 pandemic, many shipyards, although not all in Europe, have had to limit or cease construction of vessels. The builder of the PPA, Fincantieri, is still in a period of shutdown on its build programs as a result of the crisis. And the latest development in the US has seen the resignation of Acting Secretary of the US Navy, Thomas Modley, following a speech he gave to the crew of USS Theodore Roosevelt as a result of the fallout from the now famous letter by the carrier's commanding officer regarding an outbreak of COVID-19 on board the ship. To discuss these developments and everything else, I'm joined by Air Editor Tim Martin and Land Reporter Flavio Camargas-Pereira. Hi, both.
Hi, glad to be joining you, Rich.
Hello.
So, Tim, can we just go from the top? And I want to address, I want to address the fact that Modley has tendered his resignation and Esper's accepted it. So what's your take on everything that's going on there?
Yeah, it's very interesting to be talking about the US Navy at this point, because it's been another bruising week for the service, as you mentioned. And, you know, there seems to be senior leadership decisions here that took many by surprise, and particularly the strong reaction and feeling from on board the USS Teddy Roosevelt in particular, perhaps would have surprised leaders. But I suppose beyond that, in terms of the significance of the resignation from Modley and what's going to happen now, and I think that pretty much, you know, the reputational damage caused by not only the firing of Captain Brett Crozier, but everything that's happened since then, and you know, the complete what seems to be a lack of faith in senior leaderships. Those two items would to me seem to be the most concerning aspects of the entire thing, and I suspect that they could prove most costly from a long term point of view. You know, if you go into the likes of recruitment and retention further down the line, and you know, this broad ambition that the US Navy has to reach a fleet size target of 355, which, you know, whatever your interpretation of that, it's always been seen as a highly ambitious target. And, you know, when you see things like this happening, it doesn't inspire confidence in outsiders' opinions, I guess, of those types of hopes and dreams, I suppose, being achieved in the long term. But beyond that, I am, of course, merely just an R editor, as we know, Rich. So, as the expert in the house, so to speak, how have you interpreted the events?
It's fascinating, isn't it? It's such a rapid unraveling of his position. So U.S. defense media noises on social media yesterday evening. So yesterday, that would be the evening of Tuesday, regarding the potential that Mowgli might be in hot water. It's clearly proved to be absolutely accurate. So it's an interesting point you made regarding the popularity of the commanding officer of Theodore Roosevelt. I think it speaks of a disconnect between the higher levels in the US Navy administration and commanding officers and crews on the front lines, which is a little bit concerning, I think, for the service. It's almost open voices of dissent from commanding officers and from crews about the direction or some of the directions that the administration, the US Navy's administration, wants to take the service in, which for an organization which is supposed to be quite rigid and structured and runs on obedience and serving the will of the commanding officers and all their chiefs, I think it's a little bit concerning that it's got to this position, that the fact that Mowgli felt himself able to make what apparently were quite strong comments to the crew of Theodore Roosevelt, obviously admonishing the commanding officer, but in doing so, also, it wasn't a very subtle warning to the crew either, asking them or telling them rather to obey the line of command. And clearly, if you look at the social media images of the commanding officer of Theodore Roosevelt when he was leaving the ship, you have hundreds of crew in the hangar of this massive aircraft carrier chanting his name as he leaves the ship. So the popularity of the commanding officer wasn't unknown by Mowgli beforehand, and that he felt he had the ability to go in organs blazing against the commanding officer and the crew, massive misjudgment. And obviously his position, as secure as it looked during the Senate committee hearings following the presidential budget request, as secure as his position looked then, it's unraveled.
Yeah, I mean, some of the political implications, I suppose, will run. But I think maybe what's been lost in this is what's been happening then on deck. You know, there's, by going off some reports, there's 4,500 to 5,000 men on board, or at least that's the capacity of the aircraft carrier itself. And, you know, they're still in close quarters. And we understand that Captain Crozier has tested positive for COVID-19, for example. Has all of those developments kind of been lost? And, you know, is it necessary here to kind of look at the practices in terms of healthcare and how the crew are being looked after? Because we don't really have a strong sense of really how the US Navy are approaching this. Or do we? Do we have a good reading of that?
Well, so obviously Theodore Roosevelt was sent to Guam, and then it was supposed, and it is remaining pierside, and its crew were supposed to remain either on board the ship or pierside. Some of the crew have been allowed into some areas of Guam, if I remember correctly, although they are not permitted to interact with the population. So there is, obviously, they have to do all the tests of these 4,000 or 5,000 people and get all the results of those tests through. Once that's done and they get an idea as to who has the virus and who doesn't, potentially some replacement crew and personnel could be brought on board Theodore Roosevelt to allow it to go back to its operations. Because don't forget, it was pulled off operations and it still has operations to conduct. So the US Navy's got to sort it out, got to figure out how it's going to test all these people, get those tests sorted, and recrew the ship and get it back out to sea as soon as possible.
Okay, and I mean, how likely do you think are we to see more measured decision making?
As much as I have been interested to see how social media and leaks have worked to bring to light this crisis on board the vessel and for the US Navy as a whole now, I don't see a softening of a position, even though a new acting secretary has been announced and will be in place. I don't see a softening of a position here, because the Navy has to instill that absolute discipline for its crew. And it's not like they're going to switch to a governing by consensus by asking the commanding officer what he thinks might be the best thing to do. And then maybe the commanding officer gets a poll from the crew. I mean, eventually you're going to have to restore order on board this ship. And make no bones about it, order has been disrupted. They're going to have to restore order, get the crew back on board, get them all pushing in the same direction and get out to sea. Now, if that's done through an arm around the shoulder or through a cuff around the top of the head, I don't know, but something's going to have to happen and pretty quickly. Mm. Okay, Tim, over to you. I think we've got something on swarming UAVs. Is that about right?
Yeah, that's right. So the X-61A, which is in development as part of wider DARPA's Gremlins program plans. I spoke with the chief engineer of the program, and he was telling me that there's been a rescheduling of plans to have a first recoverable flight from Dugway Proving Ground just in Utah. So, I mean, quite interesting to get that. I mean, we, of course, over the last number of weeks, we've been focusing on production rates and what some of the slips might be in terms of program acquisitions and things like that. But maybe one of the things that you forget about is that there's a number of programs here that, that are like technology demonstrators, for want of a better word, that are looking to push, the boundaries of kind of aerodynamic flights and be able to prove themselves as concepts, as for want of a better word. And one of those, yeah, as I mentioned, Gremlins. So Dynetics are the industry lead here, and they were supposed to be flying to have a recoverable flight at some point in June, but they've told me that the US Army have a directive that there's no more than 10 people that are allowed to be involved at any one time at the flight test facility. So that's almost tied their hands, because they've told me that it's not feasible for them to work to that, and so they're now awaiting a rescheduled flight test to begin. And I should also mention that this all follows a maiden flight that was made in November of last year for the X-61A.
Sure. So this is, let me get it right. This is a development program. So once phase three concludes, I think is it by the end of 2021, something like that. Is the US DoD on contract beyond that, or is that potentially the stop date for this program?
Yep. So officially, it is a stop date, a firm stop date. There is absolutely no indication at this point that there will be, a program of record, for example, or enter into low rates of production. But what I would say is that when I spoke to Dynetics, they said that it's something that US DoD are very much interested in, and given all that's happened in the recent weeks, they've said that DARPA still continue to have confidence in what's going on, and that they're certainly confident themselves that they'll execute the recoverable flights, for example, as and when they get the approval from the US Army. But I think, I suppose from a wider perspective, we should maybe just dig into some of the details on the X-61A as well, because it's considered a reusable small UAS system. And the idea being that the approach to design certainly is that it could be low cost, is one of the main attributes here. And it also has a loitering capacity of between 1 to 3 hours, just hanging in the sky, to take ISR data. And it could also be potentially used to feed UCAVs with targeting information and things of that nature. That's really the general sense that I get of what's going on here with the X-61A. And they're also using, in terms of propulsion, they're using the turbofan engine, which is used for the JASSM-ER, so the cruise missile. So this is certainly not business as usual in terms of, for example, the general perspective of UAS manufacturing for many years is, a simple airframe design and then the Rotax engine as well. And so this is very much different to that, and certainly, it's to the credit, I think, of DARPA and to Dynetics that such a kind of pioneering approach is ongoing here, and they're making good strides to make sure that they stay on track with it.
Yeah, it's an interesting program. I've been fortunate enough to speak to Dynetics a couple of times over the past few years, and they've got lots of enthusiasm for the work they do. I guess this is effectively a swarm, isn't it? A swarm of UAVs launched from a manned platform, which is the holy grail of ISR, isn't it?
Absolutely, which is kind of, you get my sense of excitement on it as well, because as I said, this is a big milestone, and that's genuine on their part, because the idea of being, what they want to do actually is to have four, and they have five, I should say, they've produced five X-61As and have them ready to go at the moment, but as it was described to me, the end game at this point is to have four X-61As recovered from a C-130 inside of 30 minutes. And if they were to achieve that, that would be a really major step forward in the program itself.
Nice one. Thanks, Tim. Flavia, onto the land side of things. What more can you tell us about, I think it's acquisitions of armored vehicles for the Brazilian Army?
Yeah, Brazilian Army intends to enhance the mobility, the lethality, and the protection of its troops. And the Army has released requirements for new types of vehicles and also an upgrade to its Leopard tanks. The Army specified operational, technical, logistics, and industrial requirements for these vehicles. And the new type of vehicles that the Army intends to equip its fleet, there is an armored utility vehicle, also an armored combat vehicle for infantry, a wheeled armored medium vehicle for reconnaissance, and an armored combat vehicle. The armored utility vehicle, it will replace the light tactical vehicle that's currently in service with the Army reconnaissance units. The armored combat vehicle for infantry, it will be, according to the MOD, the Brazilian MOD, it will be the main platform for the armored infantry units. These units, they are currently equipped with the M113. About the wheeled armored medium vehicles for reconnaissance, they will be 6x6 vehicles, and they will keep the Army's mechanized cavalry regiment. And these units, currently, they operate the EE9 Cascavel, that's a vehicle with Brazilian technology manufactured in Brazil. And the armored combat vehicles, it'll be a tracked armored fighting vehicle. And for all these types of vehicles, and including the upgrades to the Leopards, they are included in the Army's strategic plan 2020-2023. And now the Brazilian MOD must decide which of these platforms will be the priority.
That's interesting, because so the Brazilian military needs a lot of armored vehicles. They don't know how much money they've got to spend on it, nor do they know whether they're going to be buying them off the shelf or developing them from scratch. So it looks like they've got a lot of questions that need to be answered before this program can move forward. Can I ask a question, I guess? What's the purpose of the Brazilian Army? I mean, it's as a force, what is its doctrine? What's it supposed to do? And I guess, will that influence the kind of purchases and procurements or modernizations that it will do?
I think what influences basically the possibility to buy or to develop, because Brazil is facing a huge financial crisis in the last few years, so it's not easy for the army. The armed forces in general in Brazil, they are struggling to develop their own technologies. The Brazilian MOD, they intends to support and to incentivize the national industry, but I think the main problem is they don't have money to put on this project. So I think these new four vehicles, or including the upgrade to the Leopard, it'll be a long-term project.
Sure. Okay, thanks, Flavia, and thanks, Tim. Coming up next, I discuss with Gordon Arthur the major defence news stories across the Asia-Pacific region over the past few weeks.
Hey, did you know that Shepherd Media is fully digital?
Yeah, of course. I've already downloaded the app.
I love that I can access high-quality stories anywhere, anytime. That's good for when you're deployed, right?
I actually like that the stories don't waste my time. It's like the editors know what and when I want to read.
And that you don't have to read them. You can watch a video or check out the infographics.
Yeah, it's ace. Did you see that piece on Iran? That piece on the Tor M1 air defense system where they outlined...
Download the free Shepherd News app on the App Store and Google Play, and you can get 3 months half price on Shepherd Premium News for a limited time.
It's that time when we cast our eyes over to the Asia-Pacific region and catch up on some of the main headlines over the past few weeks. And that means having a chat with Gordon Arthur, Asia-Pacific editor. Gordon, hi, how are you doing?
Hi there, Richard. Good to talk to you. And we just about missed each other on the session too because of daylight savings.
Yeah, indeed. We've got a little bit closer to each other by a couple of hours, which has made it easier for me slightly later in the morning and easier for you slightly earlier in the evening. So not too bad at all.
That's good, yeah.
So what have you got for us? I think we've got something from Australia to kick us off.
Yeah, so we've been following this one for quite a while now. So the Australian Army, they've been operating the Shadow 200 tactical UAV. So they're actually looking for something to replace that, something a lot more modern. And this is happening under the aegis of Project Land 129 Phase 3. So the various companies have sort of put in offers and types of platforms that they can give to the Australian Army. And they've actually narrowed it down to a quartet of companies and their offerings. So these four companies will now move forward into a sort of a limited request for tender. And I assume you'd like to know who those four companies are.
Yes, please.
So we have In-Situ Pacific, Leidos Australia, Raytheon Australia, and Textron Systems Australia. Did you see all those mentions of Australia in there?
I did. It seems to, it looks like they've gone for domestic capability over foreign suppliers.
Well, I'd say it's the other way around, actually, Richard, because if you think about it, all these companies, Raytheon, Textron, et cetera, they're all American companies. So they're offering platforms which are pretty much primarily from overseas. But, of course, the Australians will be looking for as much local content as possible. So that'll give opportunities for sensors and payloads and various things like that for small to medium enterprises within Australia to get involved. So not all of these companies have come out yet and actually said what specific platforms they're going to be offering to Australia. The one that we do know, and Leidos Australia actually released a press release, so they've actually tied up with Aeronautics in Israel. So they're going to be offering the Orbiter 4.
That's interesting.
Some of the others are playing quite coy about what they're actually offering. Raytheon Australia, for example, nothing has been announced publicly, but a little birdie has told me that possibly they have a tie-up with Schiebel in Austria. So interesting days. We're just waiting to see what each one's going to come out and offer to Australia.
That is interesting. I mean, you mentioned Schiebel. I can only assume that that's the S-100 then, the camcopter, right?
Correct, yeah.
So that would, in theory, be the only rotary wing UAV potentially put forward for that program, unless I'm getting my UAVs.
Yes, I believe so. Yeah, I think the In-Situ Pacific and Textron, they're both offering fixed wing, I think the Aerosonde and then possibly the integrator. So, that would be the only rotary wing solution. Of course, Australia is familiar with the S-100. The Australian Navy has actually got the S-100 camcopter at the moment, and they're using it as an evaluation program just sort of to inform their program, because they have a similar type of program underway looking for a shipborne version of a tactical UAV.
What sort of timelines have we got for this program?
The winning platform should be announced next year, so 2021. And then we're looking at deliveries from round about 2022 to 2026. And these will be operated by the 20th Surveillance and Target Acquisition Regiment, which is based in Brisbane. So they're the ones operating the Shadow at the moment.
Okay. Well, it's an interesting lineup of companies and potential platforms that might be that might have a chance of winning the the whole program. Let's move on to where should we go? I think we've got a couple of stories from Japan.
Let's hop all the way from Australia in the south up to Japan in the north. Right. So 19th of March, the Japan Maritime Self-Defense Force, they commissioned the first of class of the Meyer class, which is a kind of ballistic missile defense destroyer. So there will be two of these ships to be entering service, and this was the first one. So obviously called JS Meyer, and it's a guided missile destroyer. Hugely expensive, estimated to be $1.53 billion for the ship, and it will be based in Japan to perform a ballistic missile defense.
I mean, we were talking just before we started recording about the sort of Japan's ballistic missile capability. Now, $1.5 billion, that's near enough getting on for the price of an Arleigh Burke. And I'm looking through some of the specs for the Meyer. And forgive me, but to all intents and purposes, its ballistic missile defense capability looks like a plug-on American capability.
Well, I think you'd be quite correct. So, if you look at the equipment employed on it, it's pretty much heavily American-based. So, of course, it has the Aegis combat system, so baseline 9C2. So the latest there, it's got an AN-SBQ 9B fire control radar. The missiles that are going to be armed on it, so SM-2MR, SM-3 Block 2A, in the future the SM-6. So these will all be fired from a 96 cell Mark 41 vertical launch system. So these are all American systems. So it obviously adds to the price, but probably works out cheaper to do it that way than to develop it all domestically. It will have its own weapons on it. For example, Type 17 anti-ship missiles, Type 07 anti-submarine rockets. So there is certainly domestic content on it, and obviously the hull and the overall design is Japanese. Yeah, it's heavily dependent on US technology.
I suppose a follow-up question I've got for you, I mean, is if America provides the BMD capability in that region anyway, why would Japan need its own? Why not just sit under the US umbrella and be happy with that?
Well, you get into issues of politics and geopolitics, don't you? So are you going to put all your eggs in the American basket? It would be a very risky thing to do, especially at the moment, because a lot of Asian countries are very suspicious or don't feel that they can totally trust America, which is making itself great again, and perhaps other countries don't feel so secure. And Japan is facing a number of peculiar threats. So just across the Japan Sea, you've got North Korea, and previously it has fired ballistic missiles into the Sea of Japan and even across Japan. And North Korea, we know, it has a nuclear program. It has nuclear warheads. It's able to put those onto missiles, presumably. And originally, when Japan was building up its ballistic missile defenses, North Korea was the sole and main reason. But I think latterly, Japan has also realized that China is also a huge threat. So the two countries have tensions in the Southwest Islands around the Senkakus or the Diaoyu Islands. And Japan is very concerned about the build-up and the capability of the Chinese or the PLA rocket force. So I guess it feels, we need these to protect ourselves.
Okay. From the sea to the air, we've got Japan charting a new course for the FX fighter.
Yes. I mean, we all know that designing and building a new fighter is hugely expensive. I mean, you just look at the F-35 program and how many countries contributed to that and how expensive the fighters are. But Japan, it seems, is pretty much going to go it alone. It's looking for a new fighter that will replace its aging F-2s, which are based on the F-16. So it wants a new air superiority fighter. and this is going to be called the FX. And there was different, it was sort of mulling different ways of going about this project. So whether it would do it all entirely indigenously, whether it could use an off-the-shelf overseas design, whether it could employ an American company such as Lockheed Martin or something similar to help them and give them technical assistance. So it seems the Japanese are pretty much going to go it alone. They will use an overseas technology partner, but it's going to come up with a completely new design for its new FX.
I mean, it's interesting that they want to use an overseas partner to assist in some of the whatever systems that they think, are maybe not as capable in their own local industry. But I mean, if you're Japan and your options are when it comes to an overseas partner, the US or potentially Europe. I mean. Yeah. Does Europe have the kind of capabilities when it comes to aeronautics and fighter development as can be seen in the US? I mean,
there was talk about BAE Systems. I mean, we know that the UK is looking at the Tempest. So that was, and Japan and the UK actually have been cooperating more. They have an agreement to share and to cooperate on different aspects of technology. So some commentators were suggesting that this would be an ideal program for Japan and the UK to work together on. But of course, Japan at the same time has traditionally been heavily reliant upon the US. So it always seemed more likely that it would choose an American partner. I mean, obviously, the F2 was done in conjunction with Lockheed Martin. So, opportunities for cooperation still, but essentially it will be a Japanese design and it'll be completely built in Japan.
Okay. And last but by no means least, some news from China.
Yeah, so just a little snippet. So Chinese media were just reporting in late March about the first deliveries of an anti-tank guided missile to an overseas customer. This was the first export of the HJ-12. So this HJ stands for Chinese Red Arrow, so it's the Red Arrow 12. Perhaps we would have thought that China would have sold it overseas before now, but apparently not. So this will be the first export for this particular system. So many would consider it to be an equivalent to the Javelin or the Spike, so third generation anti-tank guided missile. So it just goes to show China, it continues to sort of carve out new markets. China has refused to say who the customer might be, so we can only speculate. But its biggest customer is Pakistan for other types of equipment. And, for example, it's actually building four frigates for the Pakistan Navy at the moment. Pakistan, Thailand, a few other Asian countries, the Middle East and Africa are the main markets for China. So we're not quite sure yet who it may have sold these to, but that's one to keep watch on.
I don't suppose we'll actually find out until we sort of see the pictures in the news, whether they're used in a conflict, unfortunately, maybe in Africa or even in the Middle East. I guess we'll just have to...
Yeah, I mean, that's just the typical way. I mean, China keeps a lid on pretty much everything. It keeps its cards close to its chest. And it doesn't like to let on who it's selling stuff to. So, perhaps in some National Day parade in some country, we might see them.
Yep, fair enough. We'll just keep our eyes open. Gordon, thank you very much for your time. Much appreciated. We'll catch you again very shortly. Thanks again.
My pleasure. Thanks, Richard.
While the podcast is a new venture for Shepherd Media, we've actually been in the defence publishing business for almost 40 years and have built up a strong and loyal audience base. Our content is trusted and consumed by key decision makers through Shepherd Media's multiple channels. One benefit of having such a dedicated audience base is our ability to offer a comprehensive range of message delivery options to our advertisers. From brand awareness campaigns across a combination of print and digital media, through targeted email campaigns or show dailies, to a multitude of online opportunities, or even advertising opportunities within the podcast itself. If you'd like to know more, please visit shepherdmedia.com/advertising.
So as militaries continue to reposition themselves to the return of great power politics, such military fundamentals as secure communications, situational awareness, and making sense of the vast amounts of data on the battlefield have now returned to the fore. The latest buzz term that's fueling the current thinking is multi-domain operations, which calls for even greater collaboration across the joint and coalition force. It's accepted that any component will not be able to work in isolation. So here to discuss situational awareness on the modern battlefield in a bit more detail is Tom Itzgrit, who's campaign lead for Information Advantage at Roke. First of all, Tom, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Tim.
I guess, first of all, interesting title that you're in charge of Information Advantage, which is a term I don't think I've heard before.
Sure.
So I guess, you know, and what does that mean, first of all? And you know, how does it kind of relate to, you know, to the modern battlefield and the sharing of information?
So I mean, Information Advantage, we use the term internally to orientate ourselves in response to customer challenges. So back in 2018, I think it was, the MOD first published their joint concept note 218 all around Information Advantage and what they were seeking to achieve with that concept note. And Information Advantage, you know, ultimately it is the use of information within the battle space to obtain an advantage over an adversary. And I think there's an acknowledgement that, you know, the term superiority, which historically has been used for both air and information superiority, in these times of constant competition, you can't take superiority for granted. And so advantage is something that is temporary. It is something that you clearly want to achieve over your adversary, and it's certainly something that the MOD is looking for in terms of, you know, how they're going to position themselves in future conflicts. And I mean, it's interesting if you look at the concept note. You know, you have everything from information as an enabler to information resilience to denial, and ultimately using information as an effect. And so that's really why we at Roke have caught on to that, because actually, it encompasses a lot of what we do as a business.
And in terms of, you know, you guys talking to the customer, looking at requirements, have you seen more urgency, you know, in this field? Is there an urgency that the modern battlefield is presenting new and challenging problems, or has this always been kind of working away in the background?
It's interesting. I think for me, you know, it's always been something that has been there in the background. You know, terms such as network-centric warfare, network-enabled capability 10, 15 years ago were the terms that were banded around. So there's always been an acknowledgement that information and networks are critical enablers to our militaries. I think now we're definitely seeing with a lot of what's going on, both in terms of the kind of the peer engagements with the likes of Russia, but also the sort of near-peer type engagements. Information is becoming that critical enabler for defence moving forward. So I think whilst the capabilities have always been invested in, I think now there is a real urgency. And you see that in two areas, really. So obviously you've got the kind of Information Advantage concept that's floating around and being agreed with the various frontline commands. But actually, across MOD, you're seeing a real drive now towards both digital transformation and prototype warfare. And so the digital transformation is clearly, you know, how is the MOD going to, how is it going to revolutionise the way that it does digital, does information? And so there's a number of activities that we're seeing in that digital transformation space. Equally, on the prototype warfare side of things, there's a recognition that, you know, the time for procurement, the windows that we're working to are often too long. And by the time capability arrives with the frontline user, technology has already moved on. And so it's interesting to see things like the pro-site warfare concept come along and the integrated warrior program that was recently announced by Stratcom in terms of how they want to move on to this prototype footing so that they are taking perhaps a slightly lesser solution but in a much more agile way so that they can keep pace with technology changes.
What about some, I just wanted to move on to sort of urban operations. Is there a separate strand of looking at, it's likely that that any future major conflict will have an element of urban operations kind of incorporated into it. I mean, does that present any significance or particular challenges from a situation awareness communications point of view?
Yeah, so I mean, I don't think there's a particular separate line of activity for conducting urban operations within a digital environment. I think the world that we operate in, the world that we all live in now, is very digitally enabled. And I think there's an acknowledgement from government leaders that, you know, whatever our next conflict is, whoever we are engaged with in the future, that, you know, 90% of the world's population in 10, 15 years will be in an urban environment. So, you know, we're already at that point where urban life is part of everyday life. There's no blurring of the lines there, I don't think. So for me, you know, we certainly see more challenges in how we would fight in an urban environment, because of course, you know, in the way that we conduct our everyday lives, if you take, you know, your smartphone example, you know, you can walk around the street with a smartphone, you can, you know, use the mapping application on your smartphone to provide you a level of situational awareness. You can get alerts from your friends in terms of where to go and meet people. And of course, you know, our militaries require the same capability, but the challenges are greater in terms of, you know, they can't use a cellular network. You know, those are, if they're on an overseas campaign, then that network is likely to be compromised. And so therefore, they need to use their own closed radio systems that have the right levels of encryption and security assurance and so on and so forth. Equally, you know, the applications that they've got, they'll need to, if they're moving from one area to another, they'll need to perhaps load new maps. They'll need chat applications. They'll need voice communications. So all of those things that we as everyday civilians take for granted, you know, our militaries absolutely want to exploit that. But the challenge in an urban environment is much greater. And then if you think whereby we would, you know, we struggle sometimes, I don't know, when you're walking out of a tube station, you know, perhaps you haven't got a GPS signal. You know, moving out of that environment, perhaps moving from your office to where you're on Wi-Fi to moving into a cellular network, the ability to switch from one mode of communications to another is, again, something we take for granted. There might be a bit of a delay in doing so. Now our militaries will need the ability, particularly in a conflict situation where the electromagnetic spectrum that we take for granted might be denied or degraded by an adversary. And so they will need the means to maneuver through that. So they will need the ability to switch from a different radio frequency, or they'll need to take a different source of GPS. They'll need to be able to understand when they're being targeted by adversaries. And so in that, you know, the things that we take for granted, you know, even talking around buildings, for example. So if you've got a radio system, you know, and I'm on one street and you're on the next, the fact that you have a building in the way, the RF challenges, the radio frequency challenges, are going to be quite difficult to overcome. So they'll need different modes and different ways of working within that mm-hmm. environment. If you then overlay the complexity, because it won't just be red versus blue, you'll fold in all of the civilian population as well, who will probably be going about their everyday lives in the same way that they were, for example, in Iraq. You know, how do you understand who is a friend or foe in that environment? And I think that's something that, again, you know, the lines of conflict start to blur. So it's a really complex situation that we'll find ourselves in as a nation. Now, I think there's a lot of work going on in that space that can help to overcome that.
So this might be a good chance to go into the I think you guys are involved in the Startle AI project.
That's right.
Which seems to be one way of you know, taking all that sensor data and starting to make sense of nowadays the vast amounts of data that you know the militaries are able to gather. So, you know, could you sort of jump into a bit more detail about what that project is and what some of the aims are?
Yeah, sure. So Startle is, you know, it's a project that we've been working on in some way, shape, or form for about the last 10 years. It's actually originated from algorithms that we developed for computer network defense. And effectively, in that scenario, we were observing abnormal behaviors. You know, what are the things that you would expect to see in a computer network? And then when things that were occurring that were suspicious, we were effectively highlighting that to a network operator to say, hey, look, you know, there's something here you might want to take a look at. Is that an intruder alert? Is it the fact that part of your network's broken or whatever it may be? And so then they could go about, whatever remedial action was required at that stage. The success for us, though, is the fact that we've taken that concept and applied it to a different domain. We've applied it with the Royal Navy, and we're very grateful to DSTL for all of their support in terms of really proving the concept and getting the thing moving forward, because their interest suddenly peaked. They understood that they could use these artificial intelligence, these machine learning techniques, to really kind of start to reduce the amount of complexity that the operator was facing, reduce that cognitive burden, to make sense of the vast swathes of data that operator was being exposed to. And so what we did over a period of about 5 years was, again, work very closely in partnership with DSTL and with the Royal Navy to understand what sort of threats they were expecting. First of all, you know, what was the intelligence telling them that they might need to be able to cope with in the future? To really kind of understand the mind of the operator and ensure that any of the rules that we're introducing were consistent with their rules of engagement and their ways of working. So we weren't doing anything different. We weren't coming up with new rules or algorithms that were away from any Royal Navy concepts and doctrine. And then we started to really work to bring in more information, more sensor feeds, and really improve the efficiency, enhance the performance of the algorithms. And ultimately, that sort of culminated back in 2018, where we took it to sea on HMS Northumberland, a Type 23 combat ship. And we demonstrated it working at sea. We demonstrated detecting, you know, threats. We demonstrated the performance of the system in terms of its ability to respond, you know, the timeliness of the response, so that then the operator, you know, in a high threat, high cognitive burden situation, is getting presented with this information in real time, and they can start to make a decision about what their next course of action is. So, you know, if a threat's coming towards them, how might they go about manoeuvring? What high value assets are they protecting that they might need to close with? What countermeasures have they got at their disposal? And they can start thinking about that part of the fight rather than just saying, is there a threat or not? And if you've got, you know, air tracks and you've got radar tracks, you've got AIS tracks and various other, that's a lot of information for someone to be spending all of their time trying to pick through and find that needle in the haystack. So really our part in that is we show them where the needle is, and then they decide what they want to do with it.
I guess the final aspect I wanted to sort of touch on was in the context of multi-domain operations, speaking to, you know, companies that are involved in developing products, but also a lot of the service chiefs. One aspect is, you know, how do you operate in a GPS degraded or denied environment, which is potentially the case if you're talking about a near peer or peer conflict. I mean, are you guys doing any work on, you know, how to maintain positional data, you know, situational awareness, your ability to navigate effectively, you know, if you were potentially denied GPS data?
Yeah, so I mean, we've within Roke, we've been working in the GPS denied, navigationally constrained, whatever terminology we want to use. We've been working in that space for probably about 25 years. I mean, there's this kind of, I guess, two things really to pick up on. One is, you know, understanding what you're up against. You know, if you're up against a peer or a near peer adversary, that's one thing. You know, they're going after your information sources. You know, they're trying to degrade or deny your GPS. They might also be trying to spoof you. And so we've developed, as I say, over the last 25 years, a number of techniques that help to do some of that interference cancellation, to start to understand, you know, whether you're being spoofed and potentially where you're being spoofed from. So again, as an operator, then you can say, hang on a minute, you know, there's somebody over there that's trying to spoof my position. I'm going to go and target them now. You know, that could be a course of action. And so we've developed a number of techniques that we sell under license to a number of prime contractors that really help in terms of increasing the resilience of the GPS source. And of course, there are, you know, multiple different sources of GPS available. So just knowing that the source that you're using is being degraded for some reason and potentially switching to a different source, you know, from military to commercial GPS, for example, might be the simplest countermeasure. But certainly some of the more advanced techniques in terms of interference cancellation and understanding whether you're being spoofed are techniques that we've been working on for a number of years. So that's the kind of the degraded degraded end of it. In terms of actually just fighting and working in urban environments, we conducted a piece of research over 5 years ago now for DSTL again, which was it was titled Dismantle Close Combat Sensors. And that was really focused on the challenges for an infantry soldier of fighting in urban areas. One of the things that we recognised very early was the need to potentially fight in you know, tunnel complexes, caves, buildings, car parks, you know, all those things that we see every day in our towns and cities. And so ensuring that, you know, that we weren't solely dependent upon GPS as a source for navigation. So one of the things that we've developed under that program, and something that we are actively working on at the moment to take to product, is a system that we called IVNS, which stands for Inertial Navigation Vision Systems. And so that technology takes, it initially takes a feed from GPS. So you understand what the last known source of truth was, if you like. And then as you move into your tunnel or your car park or wherever it may be, it switches modes into this inertial visual nav system. And that system then effectively, it's using a commercial grade IMU, and it uses an optical system, a relatively low cost optical system. And it's calculating the drift between the IMU and the visual system. And that system then allows you to know your own relative point of truth. And so you can move through a tunnel complex or through a car park or whatever it may be, and you can understand, you can breadcrumb your positional information, all linked back to that last known point of truth. And again, when you come out of that environment, you know, it would connect back to GPS, because that process is quite computationally heavy. The guys at Roke have been working really hard to reduce that computational burden, so they can go down onto something like a smartphone type processor, you know, something like an S8, S9, you know, handset, and that's got all of the processing power that we need to run those algorithms, so that you can confidently navigate in an area that, you know, you never would have got GPS in the first place. So, to answer your question, yeah, we're doing a lot of work in that space, because robust position navigation and timing are absolutely critical to support an information systems in military operations.
This is a real, really fascinating area. Tom Eskeritz, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
So this is a part of the show that we call Industry Voice, which is brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, Nemo. On the line is our regular contributor, Andre Lons, who is the SVP of Communications for Nemo. So Andre, how's life working from home?
You know what? I actually think it's going to be a bit of a transition going back to working in an office again. Now I've been doing this for so long. This is the new normal, right?
Yeah, everyone's feeling that. Yeah, commuting into work is going to be very unusual.
Yep.
Just to set the scene a little bit this week, I think the last time we saw each other in person was at DSCI in London.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a sort of a regular thing for us. You know, we probably see each other 3 to 4 times per year at the various aerospace and defence events and exhibitions.
Yep.
Just given that's the natural cycle for the industry. But this year, obviously, things are very different. And we had the Singapore Air Show in February, which went ahead but was very sparsely attended. It's likely that we'll see very few events in 2020, if any.
Hmm.
You know, how are you guys looking at this situation at the moment?
Well, I think at this point, we're a little bit like everyone else, trying to get a handle on, okay, what are we going to do this year? What are our commitments long-term? And how do we balance those commitments with that continuing uncertainty that I think both ourselves and everyone else is seeing? I think from my personal perspective is that I don't think, like you said, I don't think we should expect any events to go ahead as planned this whole year, really. A little bit varying from country to country, and especially in the US where you see variations from state to state. So I think we still have to see, for instance, with the major AUSA show in October, a little bit how that's going to turn out. But it's going to be different from past years. I don't think we should plan on everything return to normal during this year. I think we'll have to call that plan B, really.
I mean, I guess even if the likes of AUSA did go ahead, from the international point of view, you know, we may not be allowed to travel to the show if there's travel restrictions in place at that point.
Yeah, and even when we return home, we could be put in a quarantine again, depending on how conditions are and what's the official government advice. So this is just something we have to play by ear a little bit. But at the same time, we have to look at what the long-term implications are as well. As you pointed out, the industry works a little bit around the event schedule. And I think that's partly because in defense, these events serve multiple purposes. They're not just the publicity event. They're not just a PR event. They're very much about the meetings. And that's also because there are a lot of things that we cannot really openly discuss through digital means in a way that other industries could, simply because of export controls or because of security concerns. So I think the general trend that we're going to see, I think we're going to see in general in across all industries, perhaps events going from having a kind of physical presence first, that a digital as a supplement. You'll see digital becoming more like the primary event, maybe a physical event as a supplement, more as a premium event for those who want to pay extra for the ability or an opportunity to network, which are things that really digital struggled the most to deliver. But I think in defense, that's going to be a harder transition simply because the networking piece and the in-person presence and the ability to meet people and have discussions without worrying about digital threats to the same degree, that's going to hold us back a little bit in that regard. Also because some of the larger events in the industry that like the biannual ones, that DSEI in September of 2021, that one, most people have made their commitments already and they're all going to sit tight and see, okay, where are things going? And then I think that's going to be in many ways crunch time for future events in this industry is how does DSEI 2021 look like? What does that look like? What's the attendance? What's the ability to really do business during that show? And once that is done, then we'll know a lot more about what the real future will be here for defense.
And then, you know, from a personal point of view, or from a NAMO-centric point of view, what are you guys looking at in terms of alternatives through 2020, in terms of, you know, getting your message out if you take away the ability to sort of see people in person?
Mm-hmm. Well, in our case, we had already begun this transition before all this happened. So we had reduced the number of trade shows we attended. We focused on a few that we considered to be the best kind of meeting places and more like the premium events that we could be visible at and wanted to be visible at. And then we've invested a lot more in digital already. So we're kind of already in that phase. what we're doing now is that we're accelerating that, and we're doubling down on our own website development efforts, online content. We're doubling down on creating our own content that can be used effectively in a digital environment, because we were already planning to go that way. So I think you'll see other companies doing the same and doubling down on those efforts. I saw another company a few days ago, or a couple of weeks ago, who did a online event that they had planned to have as an in-person event in the defense business. So it's clearly possible, and it's something that can be done. I haven't seen any feedback on how that went, but I can definitely see the value of that going forward. We did a first launch of a fully Norwegian-built space rocket in 2018, and we used that as a live event. That was the first time we'd done something like that in Norway, and that also proved that there is a huge market and interest for live events that can be accessed by a wider audience. So I think we could see this, well, there's a rainbow to everything, right? I think we could see this as a way of maybe opening up some of the defense events, making them less closed and less, well, I think a lot of people actually see them a little bit on like suspicious eye. Here's the arms fair. Let's try to demystify the industry by using this as an opportunity to make it more accessible. And for the networking piece and for the meetings, let's have a few events left that we can meet at and maintain those important relationships. But otherwise, maybe see if we can use this as a opportunity to open up and widen our audience.
Sure. And just a shameless plug from us, Shepherd Media also went digital only.
Indeed.
And we're finding it, we're at the point now where the number of people accessing the apps far outweigh the number of magazines we were printing sort of back in the olden days. So
exactly.
The environment is changing very rapidly. All we can do is sort of, I guess, hold on for the ride for now and then see where we end up.
Yeah, the only thing is don't bet your future on living off physical events. I don't think that's going to be the big one right now.
Sure. Andre, enjoy your Easter break, and we'll speak to you next time. Thanks very much.
Will do. Bye.
This episode of the Weekly Defense Podcast was brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, Nemo. As always, a big thanks to everyone that took the time in being a part of the episode. And for our listeners, make sure you like and subscribe, leave a review on iTunes, and tell a friend or a colleague about the podcast. Until next week, thanks for listening.